This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Vicki Robin. Vicki has been a key instigator in numerous sustainability initiatives, including the New Roadmap Foundation, Sustainable Seattle, the Simplicity Forum, the Center for a New American Dream, and Transition Whidbey. She is also a co-creator of Conversation Cafes. Vicki has lectured widely and appeared on hundreds of radio and TV shows. Her book, Your Money or Your Life, co-authored with Joe Dominguez and published in 1992, was a New York Times bestseller and is available in 10 languages. Vicki Robin is here today to tell us about the new version of Your Money or Your Life, 9 Steps to Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence, revised and updated for the 21st century, and co-authored with Joe Dominguez and Monique Tilford. Welcome, Vicki. It's wonderful to have you back.
Hi, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Your Money or Your Life, and what is the goal of the book?
The goal of the book is to give people a set of very practical tools that allow them not just to manage their money better, but to rethink their relationship with money, to see money in a new way. And the result of which is, if people follow this step-by-step program, is that they actually start to distinguish between consumption that makes a difference in their lives, that makes their life more wonderful, and consumption that doesn't matter at all. And so in that process of being able to see what consumption is simply driven by, you know, childhood programming, advertising, competitive consumption, when they start to see that and see that the game is not worth the candle, that consumption is not buying them what they want, then they will tend to temper their consumption and, you know, the things that they buy, the money that they spend, such that on average their expenses go down by 20 to 25%. That's a good result in of itself, but why do I care about it? First of all, I think that people at a spiritual and emotional level are so confused and tied up with money in their lives that they're abandoning the things that are most important. They're abandoning their friends and their family. They're abandoning their health. They're abandoning their relationship with nature. They're developing a constructed sense of themselves as a function of the marketplace, as a consumer in the marketplace. And it's just, it's a sad and sorry state of affairs, and I really care about individuals. It's also the fact that overconsumption is the biggest driver of environmental degradation. Because right now, I mean, now people are conscious of climate change. They're not quite as conscious of peak oil. They're not as quite as conscious of resource depletion. They're not quite as conscious of the fact that we are in a condition that's called scientifically overshoot. In other words, overshoot is when any species consumes more of its available resources than can be regenerated. So whether you're deer eating nuts and berries or a squirrel, or whether you're human consuming more of the resources of the entire planet than can be regenerated, you're in a condition of overshoot. You can think of it like we're in ecological debt, that we are consuming on an annual basis, according to the measures of the ecological footprint, 25% more of the resources of the planet than can be regenerated. In 1986 is when we started into overshoot. So in 1986, on December 31st at 11 o'clock and 55 minutes, we'd used it all up for that year. We'd used up our allowance. But now, overshoot day is September 23rd. In other words, by September 23rd, we've used our allowance for the year. And so the rest of the consumption is actually drawing down our shared resources. And you know that if you go into debt year in, year out, what happens is that you crash. Well, we're actually in a condition like that on the planet. And if we were over-consuming and it was the best party in the world, well, okay, let's use it up, have a great party, and then it's the game over. You know, the life on the planet becomes incredibly compromised. But the overconsumption we're engaged in, most of the time, it's not really making people happier, and it's making a lot of people miserable. So not only are we going into ecological debt, but it's actually having a contrary effect on the well-being of millions and billions of people on the planet, even the very wealthy. When you take a look at them, they still don't have a sense that they have enough. They don't have that contentment, that peace of mind. So it's a psychological service, it's a spiritual service, and it's an ecological service. And the program in Your Money, Your Life, our relationship with money and stuff is so crucial to all of these deficits that we're putting ourselves in. So that was our inspiration to put the program that Joe Dominguez developed for himself in the 1960s, and that he and I practiced in the 70s with no concept of teaching, it just sort of felt like, you know, the cat that ate the canary. We felt like we sort of graduated from the obsessive, compulsive relationship with money and stuff, and that we were having a grand old life. But then we noticed that these problems were brewing, and so we decided to teach it, and we taught it in the 80s, and then we were approached by the publishing industry to write the book, so we did. And then just this last year, I've known for quite some time that the value of the book, the perennial wisdom in the book, the perennial practical knowledge about managing your money was falling into oblivion because a lot of the assertions and the statistics and the stories and the suggestions, they were all fading into, you know, they were looking sort of antiquated. They came out of the 1980s. And so I wanted to just go through word by word, line by line, stat by stat, story by story, and ask, is that still true now? And if it isn't, is there something that's more true? So that's why I did the update, which I was completing in August when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac started to tank. And I knew, I told people, this is the beginning of the end, folks. We're in it now. And so as soon as I turned in the manuscript, the publisher said, we're going to get this out in no time flat. So it came out December 10th. And in that week, it was almost in the top 100 on Amazon. So it's having a new life. And actually, I'm enjoying tremendously coming back out, you know, from many other endeavors and talking about it.
How much is enough and how can we determine what is enough?
I call it your enough point. You know, how much is enough of anything, really? What is that Goldilocks moment when it's not too much and not too little, it's just right? Having enough sounds like, oh, you're just sort of squeaking by. But what I consider enough is sort of a luscious, full, abundant sense that I have everything I want and need, but nothing in excess. That, you know, all the goods and materials, all the food that I eat, all the friends that I have, all the commitments that I make, everything that I own, all the experiences that I have, they're all in that Goldilocks range of satisfaction and contentment and completeness. It's a dynamic place. Well, how do we know how much is enough? And as hard as economists might work to define that for all of us, the truth is that it's each person will have an individual calibrated sense of what is enough by paying attention day in to day out of what types of consumption, what types of products, services, experiences, commitments, what things actually bring them happiness, pleasure, and take them towards their dreams and goals and values, and what things really don't contribute. They're just a waste, basically. They're clutter in your life. And so as you examine this on a day-in, day-out basis, you know, it's sort of like your appetite. You know, well, if you pay attention to your eating, you will notice when your appetite is satisfied. Most of us don't pay attention. We just like, you know, go for it. It tastes good. Well, it's the same thing with purchasing, with spending money and acquiring things, is that we don't have an awareness of when that appetite for whatever it is, whether the appetite for a nice living room furniture set, when that's satisfied, when you can sort of kick back and just enjoy the furniture. You know, we sort of like, oh, well, this is nice, but, you know, I saw this new couch. Maybe I'll get the new couch or redo the bedroom. Or it's a constant process. We're trained into a more is better mentality where it's never enough. You know, no matter what you have, it's never enough because we keep thinking that more would be better. So enough would be that aware point of ultimate satisfaction maintained moment by moment over the course of your life.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Vicki Robin, co-author with Joe Dominguez and Monique Tilford of the book Your Money or Your Life, 9 Steps to Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak about the relationship between money and life energy?
Yeah. That's a great question. You know, in this society, we don't really know what money is. And that seems like such a strange thing because we're so focused on it. But when you ask people, like, what is this stuff? They start to think, well, you know, there's a sort of a basic transactional level of money where it's the pieces of paper and metal and plastic in your wallet. It's your bank account. It's your insurance. It's the garbage sewer and electricity. I mean, it's the stuff you use to pay for the things you need in life. But there's also an emotional level of money. You know, money is security. Money is oppression. Money is evil. Money is abundance. Money is good. Money is my friend. Money is my enemy. It's like, you know, money is the way we keep score. Money is prestige, power. It's like that we have so many internal messages, money myths, things that we think money is, which it isn't. It just represents that for you. How? Well, in part, it represents that for you because of the household you were brought up in. You know, your parents, who also didn't have much awareness about money, I mean, in a larger level, your parents had conflicting messages about money. You drew conclusions from your experience with them, whether it was the conversations around the dinner table or the deprivation or they bought you stuff, but they never spent time with you. All of that contributes to this money personality that we run around in. And so if you think about that, if you think about being able to identify and become clear about your money personality, you ask yourself some questions. Well, you know, what was my mother? What was her attitude toward money? What was my father's attitude toward money? What conclusions did I draw? How do I act towards the money in my wallet? You know, do I hoard? Do I spend every penny I get? You start to ask those questions and you realize, you start to ask, and why? Is that really real for me, or is that just something that I inherited? That can give you a real sense of mastery of money. And then there's also the cultural messages. The, you know, we live in a culture that worships progress, this idea of more is better, that we are always advancing at the level of material progress. And if we're not advancing, then we're failing. You know, it's like the recession and the depression. I mean, yes, people are suffering, but we sort of can't stand contraction in this notion of more is better. And so any kind of contraction, even if it's a healthy contraction, feels like deprivation. So those are all sort of like, you know, we swim in a sea of misunderstanding of money. And what we say in Your Money, Your Life is like, okay, let's just cut through all that and take a look. You know, a Martian comes down to Earth, you know, some meta being is watching our behavior and says, well, you know what? People go back and forth to this thing called the workplace. And then from time to time, they get this thing called a paycheck. So obviously, they're trading the hours of their life for this thing called money. And that's really what money is to you. I mean, and each of us has a different definition there, because for me, you know, my hourly wage calculated from all my different activities, you know, my hourly wage might be quite different from yours. But I know that my hour, that when I spend, for example, $20, and that would be an hour of my life, then I know that I want to spend that hour well and wisely, you know, because it's an hour of my life. It's not just $20. It's an hour of my life. My life is limited. I probably have 75, 80, I don't know, maybe at best 90 years. Well, I'm going to spend a third of that sleeping, so I'm back to 60 years, you know, and probably spend a third of that making money. And then a third of that is sort of discretionary time. So I have about 30 years of discretionary time. My whole life, everything I care about has to fit into that time. You know, all my relationships, all my relaxation, all my philosophical musings, all of my church going, all of my everything has to fit in there. So you think about the third of your life that you're going to spend making money, that investment of your life, you know, when you go spend it in your discretionary time, that better buy you the life you want. That's the thing. We want to maximize our fulfillment and satisfaction for every hour of our lives spent, whether we're spending it making money, spending money, or most of the things that make life worth living are actually non-material, as everybody knows. So however we're spending our money should be contributing, however we're spending our life energy should be contributing to the best life we can possibly imagine living.
What do you mean by frugality, and what's the value of frugality?
Well, frugality is a great word, and it used to be 100 years ago, if you said about somebody, oh, well, he's a frugal man, you would mean that he takes care of his family well, and he stewards his resources well and wisely, that he doesn't get bamboozled by the latest fad and fashion. A frugal man is an upright man, a man of integrity. And I say man because, you know, back 100 years ago, mostly we talked about the person in the marketplace was usually the man. So somehow in the last 50 years, if you say he's a frugal man, that means oh, he's a penny pincher and he deprives himself and he doesn't have any fun and, you know, he's a loser. So, I mean, we tried to, in this book, redeem the word frugal because really this idea of being able to use our resources well and wisely, whether it's at an individual level of life energy or whether it's a social level or the ecological level, we really need to get the maximum value for every ounce of resource that passes through our hands in our lives. So for me, frugality means using everything that passes through your life well and wisely, really enjoying something, using it up. You know, there's that old Maxwell House, good to the very last drop. And frugality actually shares a root with the word fruit. You know, it's juicy. There's a Spanish word, aprovechar, which means to make the best use of something. So you might aprovechar a peach, just like really enjoy it. But you could aprovechar your laundry detergent, you know, and just like making sure that down to the very last scoop in the detergent. So that's what it is. It's actually a positive relationship with the material world, not just like letting it flash through your life without consciousness. It's actually enjoying the passage of things for your life.
And what do you mean by financial independence? And could you comment on financially independent thinking?
Well, financially independent thinking is sort of a key to your money, your life, because it's really being able to, when you encounter your own desires, when you encounter cultural assumptions or the advertising, things go better with Coke, you know, you'd be really able to say, who says, is that real for me? You're really able to unpack these assumptions and these sort of eternal truths that really aren't true at all. So financially independent thinking is being able to step outside the thrall of the consumer culture and think for yourself. So you're independent of the financial programming that you grew up in. And for us, financial independence, when we talk about it in the book, I would say for me, that idea of being able to unhook from the consumer culture, if you can do that, a lot of other stuff falls away. So financially independent thinking, I think, is really that. It's not thinking about, oh, if I had $1 million, then I'd be happy. That's not financially independent thinking. That's thinking inside the box of more is better and money makes me happy, etc. So that's the first level of financial independence. The second level would be getting out of debt. Because if you're in debt and the economy goes through a hiccup like we're going through now, which is in the larger scheme, it's a hiccup, but right now it feels like a tsunami. If you go through that and you don't have any debt, then you're stable. I mean, people are losing their houses now because they're so leveraged. You know, if you're very highly leveraged in your life, it might seem like the day before the crash happens that you're a rich person, but the day after the crash happens, all that stuff disappears because you don't really own it. So the second level of financial independence would be getting out of debt. And the third level would be having savings. I mean, having at least, as every financial planner will tell you, it's sort of out of fashion, but it's really a wise thing to do, is to have 6 months of basic expenses in ready assets in some form that you can convert it to cash fairly easily. And that's true for me. So, I mean, for me, the economic ups and downs, they happen out there, but they don't happen in my life because I have sort of a steady state enoughness. And since I'm always living within my means and most of the time below my means, I have a steady accumulation of something called savings. And I have enough savings now that I'm not having a problem. The economy's having a problem. The banks are having a problem. But Vicky is not having a problem. So basically, that's another layer of financial independence. I'm independent of the economic ups and downs because I have savings. And sometimes your savings are kept in bank accounts. But, you know, right now I'm seeing that a good place to put some of my money, my surplus cash, is into things. You know, when the financial markets are booming, then it looks like it's good to invest in the stock market. But when you're in a bust cycle, then a lot of products, the price is coming down because there's not a market for them. So now's a really good time to invest in some real stuff, like real estate or, you know, the best shoes that are going to last you for the rest of your life. Things that are actually durable goods that are going to last a long time. And then another layer of financial independence really would be having the skills to do things for yourself. I mean, our degree of helplessness in terms of competency and just taking care of things, whether it's our personal finances. Do we need an accountant, a bookkeeper, and a financial planner? I mean, this whole passel of people that we have to bring into our lives because we don't know how to do anything, because all we're doing is working on our little narrow job. So the more things you can do for yourself, the more skills you acquire, the more independent you are of the need to constantly be paying other people to do your life for you. Community is another layer. I mean, I find it so amazing in this culture that we've defined the loneliness of hyper-individualism as freedom. I think freedom is having a network of friends who do for one another. I mean, because then you have the freedom to know, I don't have to know everything and have everything, because I have some things, my friends have some things, and we share, you know, we share. And it's like, oh, no, socialism. But I just think there's a freedom that comes, a relaxation that comes when you're not in a frightened state that the only thing between me and devastation is money. No, between me and devastation, if I would experience it at all, is the falling away of a very intact network of friends. So the more community you have, the more reciprocity, the more you have people doing for one another without any concern of accounting, the more financially independent you are. And ultimately, financial independence could be having savings sufficient that if you invest it in a secure way, you don't have to go to a job every day to produce the money that you need to live your life.
Would you say just a few words about the specific techniques that are used to attain financial independence? We obviously don't have time to go into detail, but
right.
To give people a sense of what they are.
Yeah, I think that the core, it's a 9-step program, and the first step is basically doing a balance sheet, finding out where you are, getting a baseline. But steps 2, 3, and 4 are really sort of the engine. The step 2 is say, money is life energy. I'm curious about where it's going. So I'm going to keep track on a daily basis of the money that comes into and goes out of my life. It's just simply developing some data about the flow of money through your life, where it goes, and doing it as accurately as possible. I mean, you can say, oh, well, more or less, I spend $300 a month on food. Or you could actually keep your grocery receipts and find out actually how much you spend, and your restaurant receipts and your candy bar receipts and your Coke machine receipts and all your receipts, or somehow or another note that down. And then step 3 is you observe, you take a look at what did I spend my money on, and you start to see that there's categories of spending that may or may not correspond to the standard budget book categories. It may not just be housing, but it's my house, my summer house, my motels, you know, whatever it is, where I lie my body down, or your clothes. It's not just clothes, it's work clothes and play clothes. So you just develop categories. Because what you're wanting to give yourself is feedback about how am I spending my money. And then what you do once you've totaled up your spending in these categories, you translate all the spending into hours of my life I invested in this. When you've done that life energy calculation, an hour of my life is, I trade it for $20, for example. And actually, the trade isn't as good as you think, because a third of that is taxes. Another third is probably, you know, useless expenses or expenses associated with your job. So your disposable income may be less than that, but just say $20. So you spend $300 on groceries. So it's a certain amount of time per month that you've invested in the workplace to get those $300 worth of groceries. Then the next step, so you do those totals, you get all the financial totals, you translate them all into hours of my life. And then you look at each one of them, you say, did I get satisfaction and happiness commensurate with the hours I invested in this? Because then you have a reality-based relationship with money. You're not just sort of pie in the sky like I deserve it or, you know, everybody does it. You're saying, is it worth my life to have spent my life on this? And so you ask that for every category. Did I get pleasure and happiness and satisfaction and contentment in proportion to the hours I invested in this? And you also ask, are the hours I invested in this taking me towards my dreams, goals, and values? Because we want our lives to add up to something more than a pile of stuff. So if you buy an SUV, it could contribute to your dreams, goals, and values simply because, you know, your goal is and your dream is to take your family, you know, and hook up a trailer and travel around the country for a year and have a great time with your family. Well, then the SUV might be worth the hours you invested. But if it's just a status symbol, it may not be. So you have to ask yourself, what's important to me? Where am I headed in life? And so you don't arrive at midlife going like, where did all the time go and what has it added up to? And what happened to what I wanted when I was 12 years old and I said, you know, God, what I want to do more than anything else in the world is to be the great American novelist. Have you written a novel? You know, so it's an opportunity on a daily basis to use your relationship with money and stuff to examine your dreams, goals, and values. And if you do those steps, if you do your spending diary and then you add it up and you translate it into hours of your life and you ask these questions, you'll find that a lot of expenses are dropping away. And there's a feeling of integrity and satisfaction and wholeness and competency and mastery, actually. Money becomes a relaxing part of your life, not a stressful part of your life.
How do you see your book helping people in the current economic crisis?
I actually think the book is more important now. I mean, in a way, when it came out in 92, we were trying to prevent the suffering that was going to come from this crash. Now people are in the middle of it, and so it's more necessary than ever. I think one thing is that if you have a sense of like, oh my God, you know, it costs me 50 grand a year to live. That's just it. As a matter of fact, it costs me 50 grand and I'm only bringing in 40. If you have a sort of fixed sense of sort of like the whole bundle of things that you need in order to survive, if you start to unpack that, you know, by paying attention daily and weekly, monthly, you might find that the bundle of stuff you need to make you happy is actually far less than the 50 grand a year, maybe 30 grand a year or 35, that you start to live within your means rather than beyond your means. And you actually, rather than feeling less satisfied, you feel more satisfied. So I think it's a strategy for rather than belt tightening overall, rather than saying, I was a bad boy and now I need to be a good boy and knuckle down. And you just simply pay attention. And to what consumption makes your life worth living, and let the falling away happen naturally. So that's one thing, is it's going to help people live within their means. And once you can live within or below your means and you can start to get out of debt and develop savings, it starts to break up certain assumptions about your work life. Like, you don't necessarily have to sell yourself for 40, 60, 80 hours a week to somebody else in order to pay that 50 grand a year that everybody knows is what you need. You might find that you could work half the year instead of the full year. You could take a part-time job rather than a full-time job. You could take a lower-paying job that's more satisfying and more in alignment with your goals. You could take a look at your house and say, how can my house be a site of production? In other words, could I rent out a room? Can I rent out the garage space to somebody who needs to store their boat? What can I do with what I have so that it'll produce an income for me? You know, I just talked to somebody who said she's moving and she's looking at all this stuff in her garage and her storage shed. And she and her husband are putting it on eBay and bringing in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. So once you start to do this reexamination from a point of view of sufficiency or enoughness or Goldilocks moments, you start to be able to liquidate parts of what you thought was absolutely necessary, but you haven't used in years. Maybe you never even took it out of the box. So there's so many ways that this program can help people see how to live within their means. It's not hints and tips per se, although there's a whole chapter in there that has a lot of good ideas about ways to save money. But it's more what you notice yourself. Like, there was a gentleman who followed this program who said, I realized doing the program that I didn't use my dining room. Now, it's not a big realization, but what he saw was that he could rejigger how he used the space in his house and liberate two rooms to bring in somebody, a couple, who could live there in exchange for daycare and yard work, which was about a $300 a month expense he had. So he called it his $300 dining room. Now you can't like make a hint and tip, like, you know, just like notice if you're losing your dining room. But it's the awareness that he brought to, like, where is the waste in my life? What am I paying for that makes no difference? He could see a way that he could trade some of the square footage in his house to cover those expenses that were actually killing him.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Vicki. We have just been speaking with Vicki Robin, co-author with Joe Dominguez and Monique Tilford of the book Your Money or Your Life, 9 Steps to Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence, published in 2008 by the Penguin Group. For more information, check on the web at www.yourmoneyoryourlife.info. Again, yourmoneyoryourlife.info. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.